about share-based payments.
Yes, okay. We are going to move straight to paper 12A. Paper 12 that had been posted was the IFRIC update from September. Now, actually, we'd already discussed that last month, and it was posted in error for this month, so therefore we don't need to discuss that again. So move straight to paper 12A, Denise.
Okay, thank you. In November 2014, the ISB published the exposure draft called Classification and Measurement of Share-Based Payment Transactions, which proposed some amendments to IFRS 2, share-based payment, and the AED contained proposals to address three amendments. One was the effects of vesting conditions on the measurement of cash settled share-based payments, the classification of share-based payment transactions with net settlement features, and the accounting for a modification to the terms and conditions of a share-based payment that changes the classification of the transaction from cash to equity settled. At the July 2015, we presented a summary of the comment letters that we received on this exposure draft. We received 70 comment letters, and the respondents broadly support the amendments, the proposals, but some respondents requested further clarification or simplification of the proposed amendments. So the objective of today's paper, Agenda Paper 12A, is to bring a summary of this comment letter analysis and to bring a summary of the recommendations made by the Interpretations Committee to the ISB. These recommendations are included in paragraph 65 to 79 of the paper, and the proposed wording for these amendments is included in Agenda Paper 12B. So I'm not planning to go one by one each recommendation, so I'm planning to address just in a general way the recommendations for each one of the amendments. So I would like to start by referring to recommendations in paragraph 66 of the paper regarding the amendment for the effects of vesting conditions on the measurement of a cash-settled share-based payment. So I would like to ask you if you agree with the recommendations in this paragraph and or if you have any comments. So 66 A and B, please, in page 18 of the paper.
Mary?
I'm sorry, I'm just looking at it. I think some of my comments might be about 67 rather than 66.
Okay.
So hold me up.
Any comments on 66 by anybody? No? Okay. We agree.
Thank you. I would like to then move on to the recommendations in paragraph 67 of the paper regarding the amendment about the classification of a share-based payment with net settlement features. So again, I would like to ask you if you agree with the recommendations in this paragraph, 67A, 2E, 2E.
Okay. Mary?
Okay. It's about C and D. Well, it's really about D and the addition of a requirement for an entity to disclose the difference between, we were talking before, the frozen grant date fair value, which is the credit to equity, and the ultimate debit, which not always but often is the fair value of the share at a later date. And if markets have been going up, especially if it's an option that would be exercised, you might expect to go debit equity 100 when you had previously credit equity, let's say 60. You know, so the requirement is to disclose the difference, which will be a debit to equity, and the amount of the cash flow. I just think it's overkill to require everybody and then just subject to the general materiality of disclosure requirement to require everybody to always disclose. I think it's worth highlighting that this may be a cash flow that is not clear, you know, from the historical data that it is coming in the future, because the debit to equity, my 100, might come 2 years after you recognize the share-based payment. It might be when somebody exercises an option. But I just think when we stand back and look at the concerns about disclosure overload, et cetera, saying that you must disclose this as opposed to highlighting that this may be significant information that an entity should disclose seems overkill.
Can I just say that this is an area that the Interpretations Committee were particularly concerned about, and I note what you say about the general materiality overlay, and that would clearly apply to this, but the committee were concerned that there would be potentially a significant outflow of cash from the entity without any kind of warning prior to that payment being made.
Yeah, and I'd say that there are plenty of future outflows of cash, including giving raises to your, you know, senior staff that are going to influence future cash flow. Just look at D in the to require the disclosure of the estimated amount, as opposed to saying, you know, having commentary that highlights that the amount, you know, that the company has agreed to repurchase shares to fund the minimum tax payment, and that this, you know, and an entity should consider whether this is information that should be disclosed because of the significance of the future outflow. Just look at how you've written it, to require disclosure of.
And I think that was the recommendation.
That's why I'm raising it. It's not just drafting. Yeah.
Okay. John Wu.
Thank you. I'm sorry, can I go back to the paragraph 21, first issue?
21?
Yeah, 21. If you see there, then you are, it is maybe minor editorial, maybe correction. I don't think we need to add that phrase and non-vesting conditions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you're saying, you know, vesting conditions in the parentheses, it's, you know, by default, you know, you shouldn't include any non-vesting.
I agree.
All right.
On the same topic that Mary was discussing, sorry, this disclosure requirement, this was something that the Interpretations Committee focused on in particular, and particularly the Sandy, who was representing the sort of user perspective. I think she was focusing on two things. One was the fact that you've got something that we've allowed them to put an equity label on, where in fact you've got an obligation to write a check. And the second thing was the fact that the amount could also be different to the amount that you've put in equity, because it's a cash obligation that could be of different value. I do agree, though, that sometimes it could be an immaterial, you know, it may not be a big deal in the scheme of everything. So I wonder whether, to Mary's point, we could... But personally, it did make me feel very uncomfortable with our decision to allow the equity label. Made me pause more than I had originally, and I wasn't keen in the first place. And I think we do need to sort of take into account that user feedback we've got. So I wonder if a way to address it would be in the basis to highlight that, in accordance with paragraph 51, which has got this sort of general, or 50, this general objective of disclosing information that enables users to understand, whether we could put something in the basis to say that that means that if you've got something that you've treated as if it were equity settled, but actually there's cash payment obligations associated with it, that could be information useful to flag for investors. And in addition, if there's differences, you know, material differences in the amount that's gone to equity versus the amount of cash that might have to be paid, that would also be another piece of information that you should be thinking about when you think about whether you've met the requirement, the general requirement in paragraph 50. So rather than the making a black and white thou shalt sort of say, by the way, there's this general objective, and when you think about these schemes, these would be particular ones to think about.
Okay.
Exactly. Sims.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not generally in favour of putting things in the basis that we think are guidance to how people should apply the standard. I mean, I think it should be in the body of the standard, or possibly implementation guidance if we have it, but I wouldn't use the basis for that.
Have we got such an animal in IFRS 2, given its structure?
Yes, we have Appendix B and IE.
We've got AG, so maybe in the AG we can put something.
Okay, yes, exactly the same point. So, first of all, I would like to thank staff to put the draft at the board table, agenda paper. So, if you look at agenda paper 12B, there is a draft, working draft. And the paragraph 51 says, they disclose at least the following. So this having at least causes a lot of tension. So I agree with what Sue suggested. So actually, IFRS 2 disclosure is always criticized whenever they have some small minor things. They feel obliged to disclose it because IFRS 2 is closely connected to remuneration of the management. Therefore, in terms of materiality, they cannot judge by the amount. They have to judge the materiality based on the quality of the information. So most preparer thinks if it is written, you have to disclose it at least. Then you they are quite obliged to disclose it. So therefore, I would agree that we should not include it as on the standard. It is not at least one, but looking at the paragraph 50, everything is written. So then by adding some BC or guidance, then eventually we could promote more disclosure about this this problem.
I'm happy with 51 as it's written. I think that we're going through a project on materiality, and that's the appropriate place to deal with this issue of people reading words shall disclose and saying I've got to disclose it, whatever the materiality. Well, we should deal with that by discussing materiality. Watering it down with could consider and should be thinking about, or taking it out altogether and relying on the principle. I know that we need to be sensitive to disclosure overload, but as Sue said, the user on the interpretation committee and the committee itself thought this was important, and I think we should respect those opinions.
Yeah, but I also thought that we had decided in the disclosure framework that often our language is 2%.
I thought we had made that decision to get rid of words at least. And
yeah, shall at least was also always used as an example of old-fashioned disclosure requirement.
The IS-1 amendments were the ones that started doing that, not the...
But it's still in the context of materiality.
Yeah, but that we are working on materiality, but we are also said we have to look at the language in which we write our disclosure requirements.
Why do we have to have the words at least?
Yeah.
Well, those words are currently in the standard, those words are already there in the standard. Yeah. What we're adding is paragraphs, subparagraphs.
Yeah,
C.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, but paragraph 52, current paragraph 52 only have A and B. And A and B is very substantial information of IFRS 2. Compared to A and B, the incoming disclosure is not as important as A and B. So therefore, it doesn't meet the criteria of current paragraph 51. That is the point. So if you could include some new paragraph saying that without saying at least or shall or some other recommendation or user's need, that might work. But if you include it as a C in addition to paragraph 51, then the value of the information should be equivalent to the A and B. But the level of the information is different, I think.
Well, I think perhaps we need clarity. Is this to be a requirement? You know, bearing in mind it would only be if it's material, but is this to be a requirement, which was the recommendation of the Interpretations Committee, or should it just be an encouraged disclosure? And we do know from past experience that encouraged disclosures typically don't get given.
And this is an exception to the principle.
But even a requirement can be written down in different ways.
Just on this shall thing and the language, again, just to reinforce that in Portuguese, shall means you must do that. So it's just taking care of the language that this is, of course, I understand this subject to materiality, but if we use shall, a number of people that believe they must, in any case, disclose. Just a warning on the language.
Mary?
I have a comment about a different paragraph, but maybe on this issue of how strong or soft the language is. Question about where we are in process. is this going back to the interpretation committee members at all for their comments?
No.
Because
no.
I almost feel like, okay, I was going to say, I think it would, I would be happy to report to them the concerns that were raised about it being too absolute and, you know, a sledgehammer, and seeing, you know, what their views were, including the views of the user members in terms of finalizing the drafting and how it's positioned. If we're not planning to, I wouldn't go back just for this. My other comment is about item E, like Edward in paragraph 67, which is saying that you're recommending that we add guidance on what happens if the entity withholds too many shares and initially treats them as equity settled, and it says, here's what you do. I think instead of, you know, I'm happy with trying to achieve that objective, but I think there's another way to do it, which is instead of writing yet another, here's what you do in this circumstance, I think it's rather making the point that this relief, this exception that we're creating for operational reasons is only for the minimum amount, and if any amount in excess of that is withheld, then it doesn't qualify. And, you know, because as soon as we start writing, if this happens, this is what you do, it just becomes a standalone requirement as opposed to pointing out that this is the limit of the exception, mm-hmm. and that it would cause anything else to not qualify and therefore be treated as cash settled, because we've written it as spelling out in this you do that.
Yeah, the reason why we proposed including this guidance is because it was raised by one of the respondents. It was a problem in a particular jurisdiction. And then we discussed it with Interpretations Committee, and Interpretations Committee wanted to make it explicit.
But I
understand your point.
I think we can still make it explicit that if you do this, then it doesn't qualify. And the consequence of that is that piece is treated as cash settled. But we don't have to give everybody all the bookkeeping for every possible scenario.
You're saying the whole thing then doesn't qualify?
No, they're just saying the excess doesn't qualify.
So it would still go down the bifurcation route then in that case. So you would treat that piece as being cash settled. That's what our suggestion was, and what Mary is recommending in terms of the outcome.
Is it though? Because I thought that this would be at the point where you knew what the excess was, you'd switch across, whereas I think Mary's would mean...
You don't know under either our approach or Mary's approach until you actually come to that payment that you have actually withheld too many shares and paid cash to the employee. So this does mean that yes, you don't get this outcome until the very end when the payment is made.
I'm not sure that's what Mary was saying.
Well, no, I was not trying to quarrel with the outcome. I was quarreling with. Don't write in another place, here's what you do, you know, here's what you do for the piece that is cash settled, mm-hmm. because it doesn't qualify, because it turns out to have been too much.
Martin?
Again, on this wording on the disclosure and 51, I think my understanding was from what we have done is the disclosure initiative, we would not use in future the word at least, because that would really think, okay, you should not take into account materiality, at least is for me, in any case, you have to do that. And therefore, why not changing, and even if it is A and B was the old, but why not changing that? And they should disclose the following. Why don't we change that? If we add now a paragraph, what should be disclosed, and delete the word at least, because I think that is all subject to the other disclosures. Why is that a problem?
Would that be better left for the materiality project?
Absolutely, because my understanding from the disclosure initiative was we should in the future not using this kind of words, at least at a minimum, should disclose, and then everybody can say materiality, if it applies, yes, I do, otherwise not. But at least from my understanding, is at least is in all kind of circumstances. That is what for me the word at least means.
Do you suggest use the opportunity of this amendment strike the words at least?
Strike the word at least, because I think, based on what we do in disclosure initiatives, that is at least
well,
my understanding
we,
what
I
we are driving for.
I think we have talked about this a lot and have expressed sympathy for this route. I'm not sure if we have. I think we're going to discuss this in the principles of disclosures, which we have not finalized yet. So I think it would not be. Although I sympathize with your suggestion, I'm not sure if
but I thought the changes which we have money
at this point add
no.
other very prescriptive requirements, so that's another thing.
He wants to take the words at least out here.
Well, if the words at least already in, is that right?
So it's we can't delete them.
No, I don't think we should.
We can't. We haven't exposed it.
We haven't exposed it. We haven't exposed the new words either.
Do we have
that's
to expose
them?
But we've already written them in IS1 changes.
Well,
I mean,
the other alternative is tax one. What about a separate paragraph?
Yeah.
So instead of making it
separate paragraph.
Look at paragraph 52 of IFRS 2,
mm-hmm.
which is the general exhortation to say if the information required doesn't satisfy the requirements, then disclose more. Maybe then tag on to that, for example, if you have X, you know, the scenario here, then disclose Y. Just move it from 51 to 52.
Yeah.
Steve? Not sure I'm going to add anything to the debate. I'm concerned about 51 is saying these are things that you need to do to satisfy the objective, but you might need to do more to satisfy that objective. Now, I know 52 kind of covers it, but I'm concerned about us making on-the-fly changes where we haven't, as you said, Hans, haven't finished the disclosure initiative.
So we're
I don't think it's just a change. I mean, I think putting in C is doing something that we're discussing we shouldn't do. I mean, by having shall at least, we're already saying those words. And so we're doing it in the knowledge that we think it's not a good idea.
Yeah, so adding, I think, would be adding another this kind of letter language again, I think, would not be appropriate either. But to take out from
that's
the existing standard is perhaps going a little bit too far.
Yeah.
So the suggestion of adding it to paragraph 52 instead, which doesn't have this at least wording, as an example, would seem to be a good position to end up in.
Okay.
Just regarding Mary's point about this paragraph where we propose guidance about the excess, I'm still not clear whether you would like to have that paragraph in the main guidance, or we remove it, or we mention something on the basis. Or
what I was saying is to redraft 33H, proposed 33H, so that instead of saying, if this happens, then here's what you do, spelling out, take this amount, put it here, saying, redraft it so the exception that we created applies only to the minimum amount. If it turns out you withheld too much, that excess doesn't qualify and therefore would be treated as cash settled.
Oh, thank you.
And don't give a shorthand explanation of what it means to account for it as cash settled.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Everybody agrees. Okay. Any other comments on the amendment on net settlement features?
Okay.
So I'm going to move on to the third amendment. For the accounting for a modification to the terms and conditions of a service payment that changes the classification from cash settled to equity settled. These recommendations are shown in paragraph 68, A to D. So do you have any comments? Do you agree with the recommendations?
Comment on D, aligned with actually comments made before and also Peter. The D appears to me something that would better fit in sort of application guidance instead of basis for conclusion. Reading generally as it is here, it's apparently an important aspect, and more important than the reason why I would expect reasons to be in the basis for conclusion, but some sort of guidance in the standard itself or in the application guidance.
So what you're saying is to move it from the base for conclusions to the
but
application guidance?
At least the application guidance,
Well, it's already in the application guidance. This is B40. Okay.
Mary?
I also was asking about that same point that Amara was just questioning. I agree with his comment that if we're going to talk about it, it seems more appropriate to have it as guidance rather than in basis. But I was more fundamentally questioning whether we should do this, whether we should add this commentary. I have two reasons for that. One is by saying, consider all facts and circumstances. I'm not sure that we're providing a lot of help by just making that observation. And second, while the while your paper says, didn't believe that the board, when it issued IFRS 2, intended to give a choice. But when I look at IFRS 2 at paragraph 28C, it just says, if the instruments granted are identified as a replacement, and there's no other commentary that I'm aware of in IFRS 2 that tells you anything more than whether or not the entity identifies it. So I don't see why in an interpretation we should be, throwing up additional commentary if it wasn't in here, especially if that was not the issue that the interpretation committee and the board consulted about. This is kind of somebody coming in after the fact and saying, let's start building guidance around what you need to do to qualify for identifying it as a replacement. So I think if that was not the subject that was consulted about, let's not start having scope creep. And if we are going to do something, then I think it would be good to do something more helpful than, say, facts and circumstances. Mm. But I'm not convinced that we should do anything.
Yeah.
Amaro.
No, oh, sorry. Well, I forgot.
So.
Can I ask, if all agree with Mary's comment of not adding any explanation in the basis for conclusions about the meaning about the meaning of identify or identify.
So explain why the interpretations committee recommended that it was appropriate.
Well, first of all, they questioned the meaning of identification and how to do that identification. And as we haven't provided any further guidance, well, then they say that you shouldn't use that word. And then there was some other proposed wording for that paragraph to avoid using the word identify, because they felt that we were asking the entity to make an accounting policy choice of whether it was or not a modification.
So paragraph 54.
Right, so are we questioning the effectiveness, the efficacy of the remedy they propose, or whether or not it should be done at all? I think Mary is questioning whether it should be done at all, as opposed to how effective this guidance actually is.
So what would the words look like? Would you?
What the question is, the meaning is, how do you do that identification? How do you identify that one award is replacing the other? And what Mary's saying is that, what the paper always also says is that we copied that wording from the wording that is applicable to modifications of equity settled awards in paragraph 20C. And what Mary's saying is that there is no further guidance for equity settled awards on the meaning of that word. So the question is, why should we provide further guidance? And our guidance, I think, is not very helpful either. on the meaning of this word, on how to do that, this identification.
No.
Yeah.
It's not new.
It's not new, exactly. It's not the use of that word is not new.
No, I don't disagree. It's just that this was the problem I thought they were trying to solve, though.
Well, it wasn't the problem they consulted about, but in considering the responses to the exposure draft, somebody said, I'm inferring this from reading the paper, somebody or more than one person said, wouldn't it be good if we provided some guidance about how you do this? And I think it's just another case of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Mm-hmm. People are trying to help, and then in trying to help, we don't know what the consequence is going to be.
So the committee had read this and thought, it sounds like a choice. We think it would be better if it wasn't set out as a choice, but in fact this isn't the first instance of this. This has been copied from elsewhere using the same wording, basically. So it's already an existing issue that is already there, as Denise was just explaining.
In fact, the Interpretations Committee, at first, they proposed to remove the word identify and just set it as an assumption or just say that one instrument replaces the other. So the wording would have gone like, when an equity settled award is replaced, when a cash settled award is replaced by an equity settled award, without avoiding the word identify.
I think what you've done in terms of using exactly the same words we've already got is absolutely the way to go, because I don't see why we'd expect people to go through a different process in one case versus the other. So it would seem to me sensible to align the words.
Yeah.
And if we've never had to deal with interpreting the words in the other context before, I agree with Mary, I don't see why now we'd want to suddenly turn around and explain how to do it.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, do you have any other comments on the amendments, on the amendment for modification from cash to equity settled? Now, finally, I would like to move on to the recommendations of the transition guidance for these three amendments. This transition guidance is shown in paragraph 69 of the paper. So do you have any comments about the transition guidance?
No, we don't. at least not quickly enough. Okay.
There was one point, actually, that Mary, you had raised with us beforehand, which I wanted to just raise and say that I thought it was a good suggestion. That is, IFRS 2, the original transition guidance for it, when it first came out, was limited to certain transactions which were after a certain date. And I think this, when we say retrospective is one of the alternatives here, we mean retrospective as set out in the original transition guidance of IFRS 2. We have some example wording in a previous amendment to IFRS 2 that limits retrospective application in that way, and I would suggest that we include that same limitation on retrospective as we did it with a previous amendment.
I wasn't going to say anything because I didn't want to look too much like a dork in public.
Been outed now.
No.
We expect you to be a dork in public.
Thank you for that expectation.
That's your role.
But I think it would be good to include that limitation.
Sorry, the final question I would like to ask, do you agree about finalizing this amendment?
Yes.
Yes.
Please.
Thank you very much.
Okay. 12B.
C.
Done.
Now on agenda paper 12C. In September of 2014, we issued an amendment to IFRS 10 and IFRS 28 that dealt with sales or contributions to assets between an investor and its associate or joint venture. Earlier this year, you were also considering a number of additional Meriscope amendments to IFRS 10 and IFRS 28 on this topic. In June, you decided that you would defer indefinitely the effective date of the amendments published in September 2014 and consider the amendments to IFRS 28 more comprehensively as part of the research project on equity accounting. Because the effective date of the September 2014 amendments is 1st of January 2016, we thought it was important that the deferral of the effective date be finalised this year. And in July, you requested and received a 60-day comment period from the Trustees Due Process Oversight Committee. The request for reviews was published in August and the comment period ended on 9th of October. This paper summarises the comments received. The comment letters raised three possible actions by the ISB. The majority support the proposals and recommend the finalisation of the proposals as worded for the reasons given. A few respondents thought that it would be better to withdraw the proposals, but the staff notes in paragraph 20 that there would be a number of practical difficulties associated with that. Some respondents would prefer not to defer the effective date, although no new arguments were raised that hadn't already been discussed by you. Some respondents also queried whether early application should be permitted, but in the paper, the staff recommends that you confirm your decision to permit early application for the reasons that were given in Basis for Conclusion, paragraph 8. paragraph. So in conclusion, the staff recommend that the proposals are finalised as worded in the ED, and if you agree with that recommendation, the staff intend beginning balloting of that wording and bringing due process paper to the December board in order that the proposals are finalised in December, in advance of the 1st January effective date of 2014 amendments. Do you have any queries on the points raised in the comment letter analysis? And do you agree with the recommendation to finalise the proposals as worded in the ED itself?
Thank you. I agree with the staff's recommendation. My first choice was withdrawal. I think we should withdraw. If we made a mistake, we should withdraw. That's my first choice. My second choice was then prohibit the early application. However, now I think I should agree with staff's recommendation and we should keep it as the worded in the ED. But let me explain why. If there is a divergence A and B, and the board concluded that A is the right answer and issued the paper, but all of a sudden board decided to stop that amendment, then the impression and the message we are giving to the market is A is the wrong answer. So then if we simply withdraw the interpretation or some amendment, that would imply that B is the right answer. So it wouldn't go back to the normal, neutral situation. If we would like to bring it back to the normal situation, is maybe to permit the early application eternally. So that's the only way. So therefore, I agree with the staff's recommendation.
Well, I agree with staff's as well. But I have maybe, sorry, a stupid question on timing, on paragraph 32. Because you mentioned that you are bringing to us in December the due process paper to our meeting in December, and publication in mid-December. So is this right? Because the meeting will be in mid-December.
The staff intention is that after this meeting, if you agree that you would like it finalized as worded in the exposure draft, that we start balloting the wording in the exposure draft with a view to being in a position to then act quickly on your decision to authorize it for issue. And the staff think that in order to give you comfort about the due process itself, that when the pre-ballot draft is distributed, we'll distribute the draft of the pre-ballot due process paper, the December due process paper, so that you can check and make sure that you're happy with the due process.
All together.
But yeah.
So then we'll be able to...
So that you'll have that comfort that we've gone through the appropriate steps as you're looking at the wording in the pre-ballot draft.
Perfect. Just to clarify to outsiders, because people can start say, well, if they're bringing the due process in this mid-December and publishing mid-December, what does that mean exactly? So we'll be actually working already in the pre-ballot draft.
And it is worth noticing that noting that it is an extremely short amendment. It is just one paragraph in each concerning the effective date. It's very narrow.
Thank you. On paragraph 20A, if we decide to change from the deferral to the withdrawal, as Doug has suggested, the first preference on this amendment is maybe the deferral is maybe not a good idea. Withdrawal maybe the more, as you said, very much cleaner conclusion. So to make that change be not possible is you are suggesting three reasons in paragraph 20. The most important reason why we shouldn't consider that withdrawal is a re-exposure need. Do you think still that we need to re-expose if we decide to our conclusion of the ED from deferral to the withdrawal?
I wasn't aware that there was a move in the board to withdraw the September 2014 amendment. My impression had been that the ISB in general wanted to continue with finalization of the proposals as worded. If the decision were to withdraw, that is a more complicated and longer process as outlined in paragraph 20. There would be a number of further factors to consider. I was not aware that that was a proposal for the ISB. It's not the staff recommendation, certainly.
Right. Based on your good analysis in paragraph 17 through 20, you suggested a withdrawal is a much cleaner solution. And as Tuck had suggested, his preference is a withdrawal rather than deferral.
No. I agree with Tuck's recommendation. But in the first place, I think withdrawal is the best, or to prohibit early application. However, that two methods do not bring us back to the status quo. I mean, cannot bring back to the neutral position.
Yeah,
because we have already gave a message, and we gave a message A and B, and A is right, but if we withdraw, A is not right. It means A is not right. That gives the impression that B is right, but that is not what we want to say. We want to bring it back to the neutral. So then the only way is to keep the ED as it is, allow early application, and also eternally defer it, so that they can have a choice.
Just to confirm what Tak said, my recollection, Shengwei, that we decided exactly as a board what is in this proposal here. It's not perfect. It's not very clean in a way, but it's a compromise given all the difficulties.
Yeah, in terms of the content of this amendment, I agree there is some kind of implication on that issue. But I'm saying very practical issue, each jurisdiction will make this amendment as a first time in 2014, September. They are trying to endorse this 2014 September amendment. Now we are going to defer that amendment by the end of this year, because the effective date is 1st January 2016. We have quite just a month is left. So, but some jurisdictions, based on this amendment, they stopped all the endorsement process. Mm-hmm. So they would like to have some kind of just a withdrawal. And regardless of what implications on this withdrawal, giving on that some kind of content of requirements, they don't care. But that practically, in operational perspective, if we withdraw this all amendment, they think much simpler to make some kind of a administrative process in each some jurisdictions. That's why Australia has also suggested some kind of a withdrawal rather than the kind of a deferral.
How are you going to deal with the Australians issue?
The Australians themselves, in their comment letter, their concern is that to the extent we give an indefinite period of effective date, that means that it by default would be effective immediately. So what they propose doing in their comment letter is to insert a notional date of 1st of January 2018, so that it will be deferred for a couple of years and then perhaps they'll reconsider it at that time. The reason I think that you decided in July that you would allow early application would be in those circumstances where it has already been endorsed with an effective date of 1st of January 2016. Some people in those areas may have relied upon the amendment where they required clarification about a very specific type of transaction. And this will enable them to still have that ability to get around the perceived inconsistency. The only difference will be that in their jurisdiction, the effective date will either be indefinitely deferred or extended to a notional date decided by that jurisdiction. So I think the reason we came upon this methodology was to keep all options open in a most pragmatic and timely solution for all of the jurisdictions involved.
I think the way the staff is recommending to handle it is the right one. Chengwu, I think it is good to bring up the feedback that we had from jurisdictions about messy process on things and not thinking through all the consequences, which is what drove us to say maybe we wouldn't mandate it because of comments raised by some not, you know, not all and not everybody agrees with them, but some that sees further potential conflicts from the 2014 amendment. But I think we all have to remember that that amendment was meant to resolve diversity in practice, where there had been, before we did anything, two different readings, including the one that we had planned to mandate. So as long as we don't force people in another direction, I think people can, you know, can do what we think is the right thing. And I think it makes it harder for somebody to change, you know, having it out there with an indefinite effective date makes it harder for somebody to change from doing the right thing to the one, to the alternative that we ultimately hope to remove, because we've gone out and said this is where we think practice should be going. We just need to resolve some of the messiness around the fringes. So I think the staff is handling it the right way, but it is a good point that several commentators made about thinking through and packaging things more so they don't get caught in this bond.
Okay. So do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
So do we agree that we... Is that everyone?
All right, so that brings us to the end of a very short week.
Yep.
Thank you.